Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, but you can call me Mike. Today, my guest is Charles F. Walker. Charles Walker is professor of history and the director of the Hemispheric Institute on the Americas at University of California, Davis. He has previously held a MacArthur Foundation endowed chair in international human rights, and he's published widely on Peruvian history, truth commissions, and historiography in both English and Spanish. Notably, his Spanish language publications include both translations of his work, but also works published originally in Espanol. His 2014 Harvard University Press, The Tupac Amaru Rebellion, was named one of the best books of the year by the Financial Times and won the Hundley Prize from the Pacific Coast branch of the American Historical Association. His other books include, but are not limited to, Smoldering Ashes, Cusco and the Creation of Republican Peru, 1780-1840, out with Duke in 1999, and I love this title, Shaky Colonialism, the 1746 Earthquake Tsunami in Lima, Peru, and its Long Aftermath, also with Duke in 2008. Professor Walker's research interests include Latin American social, cultural, and intellectual history, Peru and the Andes, the history of catastrophes and natural disasters. He's written on earthquakes, and we're both in Northern California. Maybe after this year, he's going to work on fires. the Tupac Amaru Rebellion, Truth Commissions, and History and Memory of the Shining Path in Peru. In addition to awards for his research, UC Davis recognized him as a distinguished teacher in 2011. Today, we'll be talking about his latest book, Witness to the Age of Revolution, The Odyssey of Juan Bautista Tupac Amaru, published by Oxford in 2020. This book is part of Oxford University Press's Graphic History Series, which takes serious archival research and puts it into a graphic or comic format. For this volume, the brilliant Liz Clark illustrated Dr. Walker's biography of a half-brother of Jose Gabriel Cordancanqui, Tupac Amaru, the leader of the 1783 Tupac Amaru Rebellion. Juan Bautista was a relatively minor figure in the revolt, who was arrested with scores of others in the Spanish repression of the rebellion, but he was not executed. Instead, he spent several decades in brutal confinement on three different continents. His life interacts with several phases of the Age of Revolution and offers a subaltern perspective on the era. As someone who teaches world history surveys and is very insecure of my command of Latin American history, I found the Latin American angle on the Age of Revolution particularly enlightening. And full disclosure here, I'm also an author in the graphic history book series. So I was so happy and delighted and proud to see more serious historical topics being brought to life in this graphic format. Witness to the Age of Revolution does a truly stunning job at literally illustrating the sprawling Spanish Empire from Peru to Argentina to Cadiz on to North Africa. Liz Clark's gorgeous artwork brings images of Iberian colonialism to life in vivid color. We also get a solid introduction to maritime history as Juan Bautista is transported halfway around the world. So reading this book is like going on a journey. I should also note that Witness to the Age of Revolution is just simply a fascinating story, comparable to the tales of the Man in the Mask, fictionalized by Alexandre Dumas. And there's a touching story of a friendship between this Andean prisoner and a Spanish priest. So it's a delightful piece of research and an incredible story in and of itself. So, Professor Charles F. Walker, Chuck, if I may, welcome to New Books in History.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Before we get into the book, which, you know, I can't praise this book enough. I think it's absolutely amazing. Before we get into the book itself, please tell us a little bit about you and how you came to be a scholar of Peruvian history. I think that as an undergraduate at Berkeley, you studied in Latin America and then went on to pursue degrees, an MA at Stanford and a PhD in Latin American history and also Latin American literature. But tell us, how did you come to be a scholar in this?
Yeah, I mean, it was in some ways just a fluky experience. I was in high school in your stopping ground, Santa Cruz County, and received the American AFS fellowship to go study abroad, to spend a year abroad. This is when, this is in the 70s, way back when, and I ended up in Argentina, in Northeast Argentina.
This was while you were still in high school?
In high school, yes. Yeah. Oh, so I spent a year abroad, and then this is before internet, so, you know, it was full Spanish. And it just, you know, coming from a little teeny town in Santa Cruz County, going into this a partially Jewish family in the midst of a very anti-Semitic coup and a very brutal coup in the 1976, it just shook my world, fascinated me. And so that really set me on the path. I always, you know, and when I was at Berkeley, I went to the study abroad program and said, I want to go to Argentina. They said, we don't have a program in Argentina. And after a sort of random, I said, oh, I'll go to Peru. And that really launched me. And it was a point when Peruvian historians had just a huge role in public discussions and debates, and people debated the Incas and colonialism and the role of Inca. So I sort of slowly, or actually rapidly, got really into this and said, wow, these are really interesting approaches. And that's got me launched into history and also into Peru.
And so before graduate school, you spent extended periods in both Argentina and Peru.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
I taught at the American School in Lima for 3 years, was a really great introduction. Began to dabble in archives and work, but it was a really important sort of, you know, experience for me.
And then in graduate school, what was your doctoral work on?
It was on Peruvian history. It was on lower classes, subaltern groups, and the Wars of Independence, the long from Tupac Amaru. I started in the aftermath of it, and then moved on looking at how lower class and particularly indigenous peasants supported Caudillos and these strong men. So, and there, my wife and I, as a Peruvian anthropologist, went to do our research in Cusco, and we stayed for almost 3 years. So we lived there for extended periods. It's very important to live outside of Lima, to live elsewhere.
Yeah, fantastic. So as I mentioned, I teach world history surveys. So I really appreciated this Latin American perspective on a narrative that, you know, I thought I knew pretty well, you know, Atlantic revolutions, Age of Revolution. And while many of us include Simón Bolívar and Toussaint Louverture in this narrative, I don't think many of us actually factor in the Tupac Amaru revolt. And you make the case that this is a chapter in the Age of Revolution. So what does adding the Tupac Amaru revolt do for our understanding of this era?
Well, I think it broadens it. I mean, I think we need to move beyond the Eurocentric view. And everyone says this, we all are conscious of this, but if you look at textbooks and things, it's a bit of a rubber band. We expand, but in the end it becomes the Dutch Revolution, the French Revolution, Spain, and now, fortunately, Haiti and the Haitian Revolution, as you mentioned, is in the pantheon. I think the Tupac Amaru Rebellion, which is 1780s, it's earlier, gives us a broader perspective. It was a very radical rethinking of Spanish colonialism. It wasn't part, per se, of the Atlantic world. It didn't confront an institution like slavery or a product like sugar, but it really sought to overthrow what colonialism was in the period. I think Juan Bautista, because this is later, as he's jailed, as he's imprisoned in this Spanish outpost in Northern Africa, Ceuta, what I found interesting were these worlds of Spanish American political prisoners, the ties they made, etc., and then also the discussion and the mentions of alternatives. Because I think within Spanish America, we often tend to err by thinking, well, republicanism was inevitable, and they were talking about different forms of monarchism, much more radical projects. So I think it's a, I think it's just a series of alternatives that are brought up in the rebellion and in its aftermath.
And it's contemporaneous with the American revolt against the British, the
right.
North American revolt.
Yeah, the I think the Spanish were very good at censorship. In part because 1780, it had, you know, the OAS was still forming itself. I think it wasn't quite the model we could expect, but it was exactly that. It was contemporaneous. And often people forget it was before the French Revolution, before Haiti. So when Tupac Amaru was really inventing his project, because as I say in my book and other scholars have said this, there's a search for a platform. The U.S. is one possibility, but there's a very creative search of what to replace the Spanish with.
Yeah. So now you've literally written the book on the subject. So can you walk us through a brief introduction to the Tupac Amaru Revolution? Causes, consequences, key events, most important things we should know. I mean, again, you've written an award-winning book on this. So give us the elevator pitch, right. And the things absolutely. We really need to know.
Well, crazy professor, warning, you know, if I go on too long, please stop me. This is one of those things that half an hour later that every viewer will turn this off. But
well, crazy professor is the target demographic of this podcast. So
perfect.
You're in good
company. Well, the year is 1780, and we're in southern Peru in Cusco, which had been the capital of the Incas. It's an area, vast majority are indigenous peasants, Quechua speaking, that is the language of the Incas. Tupac Amaru himself is an ethnic authority, a curaco, or cacique. These are the representatives, the linchpin, if you will, between indigenous communities and Spanish colonialism. Many of them, like Tupac Amaru, had Inca roots, and that's why his name was Condorcanqui, which you pronounce quite well, but he also used his Inca name, Tupac Amaru, to emphasize. The Incas had an amazing amount of prestige still. So the context are the Bourbon reforms. This is a series of measures by the Spanish to basically to pay off their wars in Europe as they're declining, in relationship with French and the English, and to some degree the Portuguese. Taxes are increased, local autonomy, which indigenous people had a great deal of, is reduced, and more pressure is put on Tupac Amaru. He sues, he uses the legal system, he seeks to fight the system. And he himself is a fascinating figure. He is also a muleteer. He runs mules from his area in southern Cusco, to the mines of Potosí and even into what is today northern Argentina. I also in the book stress the importance of his wife, Miquela Bastidas. She is, very common today in Andean households. The woman runs the household economy and their business, if you will. She stayed home while he was running his mules. She collected the credits, complete credit economy. She's making sure that people are paying. She's making sure they have enough food for the next year, these sort of things. And in the rebellion, she proves to be brilliant in logistics. She's the one writing letters to him. Get back here. We need bullets. The harvest is coming. We're going to lose people, these sort of things. So one of the underlying arguments I make, really it's a primary one, I would say, is her role. So
yeah, that came out in the book quite well.
Great. So it starts in late 1780. They capture a corregidor, a Spanish authority with whom Tupac Amaru had lunch earlier the day. He then kidnaps him, a public trial. He brings in indigenous people and others. We actually have an Italian visitor who gives us a testimony of it. And after several days, they execute this authority.
So the rebels hold a trial.
Right. They hold a trial, much of it in Quechua, and say and they're saying, we're doing this in the name of the king. We are fighting because which is a very standard Spanish, if you will, subaltern tactic or regional tactic to say, we're killing this guy or sending him out of town or tar and feathering him because the king wouldn't like what he's doing. But so this is November 1780, Tupac Amaru leads his troops and they go out and raise haciendas, the estates. They bring down the hated informal textile mills, the obraques, they burn many of them and they go after Spaniards. There's actually a term in Quechua, Pucacunca. It's a wonderful translation because it means redneck, not our redneck, i.e. those who, when they work in the fields in the high Andes close to the equator, get sunburns like myself really quickly. And go after them, but Tupac Amaru says, don't go after Creoles, Mestizos, and others. It's just bad Spaniards. So
just the Peninsulares, just the
exactly,
Spaniards.
And the bad ones. So, yeah. So one of the themes is it'll come back because who is a Spaniard becomes one of the defining themes in the later role. The sort of second larger argument of the book is Tupac Amaru spreads rapidly. He goes down towards what is today the Peru-Bolivian border, like Titicaca. He comes back. He sieges Cusco, doesn't take it, and then comes back to his base and grows. But he's captured in April 1781, and he, Miguela, one son, their inner circle, are executed on 17th of May 1781 in this grisly, brutal fashion. He's quartered. She is strangled with a groat. Garrett has her tongue cut. Her children have to watch this. And this is one of those, I don't know, Washington crossing the Delaware, one of these moments in history that almost every Peruvian knows about this. It's depicted everywhere in Cusco. But what I argue in the book is the rebellion was not over. It actually continued. And we all knew this. In fact, I had written about it, but most of us put another page or two by his cousin, one of his children, and a relative of Miguela Bastidas. And it actually continues for 2 years. It radicalizes, and it becomes this questionable term, a caste war. By then, anyone who's using a button shirt, anyone who speaks Spanish, could be considered a gachupin, a royalist. And on the other side, for the Spanish, anyone who speaks Quechua, anyone who's indigenous, is presumably a rebel. So you get, you know, and the death rate just grows incredibly because there are no prisoners anymore. So towns of 560, except the people who could run out, you know, I realized that they're all dead and things like that. And it goes on for 2 years. The Spanish at one point are
2 years after the execution of Chumukka.
Yeah. So it goes on into 1781, 82, 83. Mm-hmm. And the Spanish at one point are saying, we're going to lose. Do we cede this territory? We protect Buenos Aires, protect Lima. And it's come and go. The rebels really dominate a huge swath of territory between Cusco and around Puno, and they link with rebels in upper Peru, what is today Bolivia. And this is when the ferocity is just, the aggression, the violence is just horrific. And in this very sort of curious ending, the Spanish offer a ceasefire to the rebels. The rebels are exhausted. They're worried about mass starvation. There's actually an environmental element here that I don't develop enough in the book, I don't think. And they take sort of a time out, saying, okay, let's catch our breath. We haven't seen our family. And it's this very tense period. The Spanish are split between hardliners and moderates. The moderates are saying, negotiate. We've got to deal with these people. They have a few reasons to be angry, where they're hardliners. And it really made me think of contemporary discourse about terrorism, said, no, these are abject, terrible people. They just want to kill us. They're murderers. They're heathens. There was a whole religious element to it. And in a long, complicated story, the Spanish hardliners take power. They claim that the rebels had broken the treaties, and they capture them and execute them in a particular, even more brutal fashion, using hot pincers and things like this. So this is 1783, and the rebellion is over.
And you depict that repression quite intensely in the book. I wanted to ask you a bit more about that. But so what was Juan Bautista's role in these events?
It was surprisingly minor. And it was one that at first I thought, he's the half-brother of José Gabriel Tupac Amaru. But in the trials against him, he's like, at one point they accuse him of carrying his brother's bed, which is, we put, it's one of the things that you have to sort of imagine that. And at first I thought,
was that a high profile thing or a low profile thing?
I think that was low profile.
In Southeast Asia, I could see that being, you know, an honored thing,
I think he was, you know, sort of a lackey or secondary. Yeah. At first logic, you know, many other historians have gone down this route of sort of, well, they were trying to protect it, you know, because in the trial records, of course, Miguel Bastidas, the wife says, I had nothing to do with it. He made me do it. She accuses him. Her husband, José Gabriel, of, you know, beating or enforcing him, but which might have been true, but it's a ruse, it's a fake to get him out. So,
right.
But I don't think he's that crucial, and that's in the end why his life was saved, because many others were executed. Dozens, up to 70 or 80 people were executed. He wasn't seen as important enough to kill.
Yeah. Could you just say a few more words on the Spanish response and the how they suppressed the revolt? I mean, there's these grisly executions, but there must have been intense counterinsurgency throughout the countryside.
There was, but the Spanish didn't go massively against the majority of the people, the indigenous peasantry. Yeah. The trials were really against people who had been at the front lines of the rebellion, the leaders, and then also Creole supporters. They really, the Spanish courts were just obsessed by where'd you get your money? Who did you meet with? And Tupac Amaru was a close friend of much of the Cusco elite. I mean, he was this fascinating cultural intermediary where he'd go out and speak in Quechua with peasants, and he spent the night there camping, you know, with his mules, but he'd go to high society in Cusco, which was then a bilingual society, Quechua and Spanish. So they're really obsessed with who are your sort of quote-unquote important people supporting you. And in the trials, they don't go after many indigenous peasants. In the aftermath, we all expected this was such a bloody affair. We thought there'd be just mass repression, white terror, if you will. And I remember reading the French Revolution is very important reading. It's almost contemporaneous with this. But I think it's two reasons. I think, A, the Spanish underplayed the role of indigenous peasants in sort of these very racist texts. They said, well, these people are just followers. They're almost mechanical. The leader says what to do with Quechua. And like, you know, or not mechanical. They're like zombies. They followed. But I also think some of the smart Spanish authorities, and there were some very smart ones, I mean, they wrote some very reasoned analysis, said, hold it, we almost lost. If we push it too far, we're going to force another rebellion. And I found this brilliantly sort of manipulated by indigenous groups who in the trials 15, 20 years later about taxes or what the priests were doing, they would always say, you have to be careful here. You know, this authority is abusing us or this priest is doing this. And we never want the terrible times of violence returned. Insinuating was always, you know, that's why my first book I called Smoldering Ashes. That was a hint. That was actually a metaphor used about this. There was the Spanish feared. They knew they couldn't come in too heavy handed. So the repression, surprisingly, they didn't go in. I'm not defending the Spanish here. The immediate repression was brutal, but there wasn't the sort of vengeance afterwards that many of us expected. And I think it's this combination of racism and fear that really marks the Spanish attitude towards Andean peoples.
Yeah, that sense of anxiety after the rebellion's been repressed, that smoldering ashes idea, I mean, that for me, that resonates with memories of 1857 and the British Raj and the great rebellion. My friend Kim Wagner has written on that, and the anxiety that really infects the Anglo-Indian, the white community in the Raj, all the way up to Amritsar in 1919. I think that Milton Osborne, when he writes about colonial Vietnam, talks about background anxiety amongst the population.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, because this is a word that I have to teach to my students, because many, there's different definitions of it, and the American definition is a little different. But in this context, Creole means ethnically Spanish, Iberian, European, but born in Latin America, correct?
Exactly. That's it. So you could be, you know, of classic Spanish last name and, you know, Jose Juan Sanchez Albornoz de la Fuente or something like that. But you might be third or fourth generation in the Spanish by this becomes very important words of independence. If these people, if their great, great, great grandparents had come from Spain, were they more loyal to Peru or were they more loyal to Spain? In fact, part of the Bourbon reforms was getting more Spanish blood in there. The idea these people would be more objective. They didn't have the networks of friendships and allies and such that the Creoles had.
And they'd be at odds with the Peninsulares, who are ethnic Spanish from Spain proper.
Exactly.
As opposed to mestizos, which were a huge range of ethnic mixings, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then
you get separate categories that become Afro-Peruvian, people of African descent. Right. It's a very important segment of Lima, and some of the soldiers sent up from Lima to fight the rebels, many of them are mulattoes, a category used in a mixed race.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that the intense levels of racial hierarchies and sorting and the terminology is just absolutely fascinating. So Juan Bautista and his wife survive the executions. They're initially released, and then rearrested. What do you think was going on there? Why?
They were initially released because he proved that he wasn't that important, and he himself was shocked about it. So he's released. They walk back home. They say they're taunted by people who are royalists. They're taunted by people who are rebels, i.e. the people who are rebels are saying you didn't do enough for your brother. And then in the sort of roundup of the family after in 1783, they're arrested again. They're tricked, brought back. Their fields are salted. And this is when what he calls his odyssey begins. Right. It's when he's tried and sent to Lima to be ultimately sent out abroad.
Yeah. So tell us about this journey. I mean, he is on this horrifying march through the Andes down to Lima and then sent literally halfway around the world. Why? What was the Spanish objective here?
I mean, it was clearly punishment, but often they sent people abroad to Presidios, to Chile, to Veracruz, to Mexico, or even up to Spain, is to get rid of them. The idea was to get rid of all remnants of the Tupac Amaru family. So what Juan Bautista, and this is what really prompted me to think this has got to be a graphic history, this is so visual. He is sent in chains with his wife, his mother, walking obviously from Cusco down to Lima, and they hit pastures that are over 4,000 meters, whatever that is, 12,000-13,000 feet above sea level. They're lacking water. His mother dies of dehydration, which walking these high, very dry Andes that face towards the Pacific. It's just a brutal trip, and this begins this long journey. You know that I mean, this is one of the, if you will, this is why it's too visual. Just think of these, you know, Cusco, Lima, around the Horn to Rio, then across the Cádiz in southern Spain, then in Ceuta in northern Africa, and then back to Buenos Aires. That is why maps are so important, and you know, this journey. And each episode, if you will, had its own horrors that he tells in his memoirs that are the base of the book.
So just tell us about some of their experience on the ships. And this is, it was a delightful surprise to me because I've been reading more about maritime history and got to interview Chris Alexanderson about her work in the Dutch colonial empire and reviewing a book on pirates, vampires. By chance, I've been getting all this maritime history in the past month. And then this book, which I thought was going to be about prisons and the Andes and some time in Morocco, there's actually a good chunk of maritime history in here. And I learned quite a bit about how the Spanish Empire existed at sea. So could you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, this was for me, I love with new projects where there's an area I knew nothing about. This is like the earthquake book. I had to go learn a lot more about the history of architecture. I had to learn about earthquakes and seismology and such. This was the case here. It was maritime history. It would first, you know, in part just for the artist, Liz Clark said, what did the boat look like? How many, you know, cannons? These are things that I have no idea about and nothing. So learning about that. But Juan Bautista gives us a very, very vivid description of the horrors in the boat, and it's just wretched from the start. He is taught, they were tied together, and very quickly his wife dies. And there he describes she's tied to him. They are, and they don't dump her into the ocean for at least 24 hours, i.e., he's mourning her, she's dead. It's this horrible scene that I don't need to go into description, but it's very vivid. We had to be very careful how to depict that. They're going around the Horn and the rudder breaks. And at one point, Joseph Dombé, a pretty well-known French botanist who's left memoirs about the boat, he actually has to pay crew members to dive into this icy water to try to fix it. And at one point he says, I threw a coin in and somebody dove in. And just the thought of diving into icy water, icy and probably quite choppy water.
They're down in Patagonia or down Terra del
Fuego? Down in Patagonia, south of
Southern, way cold
water. Barely make it. The prisoners, you know, are not cooked. Juan Bautista talks about not having an adequate cover. They're freezing every time this icy water comes. They come to Rio, which you think, well, Rio is a beautiful place. It's going to be warm. And he says, my suffering got worse because they tied him to the boat and wouldn't cover him from the sun. So he said his skin was peeling from sunburn. And by then, a significant number of the prisoners had died on board. And only when they finally, months later, launched across the Atlantic, it's worse. Scurvy is hitting hard. And I didn't know, you know, I have the one little factoid in the book, scurvy killed more people in the 18th century in boats than all of the maritime battles put together. Mm-hmm. So they're losing, the prisoners are dying around him. And the Spanish are worried about if they were to be taken by an English ship, they're boarded, they would free the prisoners. The prisoners are either tied on deck or hidden below. He has one terrible incident where the crew, and he is just virulently about how brutal the crew was to them. They tricked him. I mean, they were so hungry, they would throw bones. The prisoners would scramble to try to get what they could. They threw a cracker, basically, and he went to get it, and they had booby-trapped it, and he fell down below, and that's when he broke ribs. And this comes up several times in memoirs of this incredibly painful episode that the rest of his life they hurt, and the only medicine was given, he was given some tar to cover it up. So this was the trip across the Atlantic, and it's just absolutely horrifying. But and for example, Dombey, who is this very distinguished, you know, he's in many books of the story of science, shouldn't be surprising. He doesn't mention ever the prisoners, who they were very evident to him. They never come up in his discourse. So, you know, covering this was one of the great but fascinating challenges. The technoparts, what kind of boat and things like that, but just the stories tell themselves because there's such vivid places, and we have such good detail from his memoirs.
So the Spanish bring them first to Cadiz and then to North Africa, a Spanish outpost. Help me again with the pronunciation. It is
Ceuta.
Ceuta. Spelled Ceuta. Ceuta.
Right.
Ceuta.
Right.
And, you know, I've been, you know, observing this place and working into my lectures for years, and it's and seen it in the news recently. In, you know, the past 5 years, you hear reports about migrants breaking through the wall, getting into Spanish territory. And it's a curious place, and the book does an excellent job of explaining this colonial frontier, borderland, contact zone, however we want to call it. So can you tell us the history of this this Spanish colony, and what was it like historically? And you've been there. What's it like today?
Yeah, well, it's just across from Gibraltar. It's one of the Hercules' pillars of two pillars, Gibraltar and the hills of Ceuta are mentioned by Hercules, a reference I didn't know. And it's the ultimate, if you will, Spanish outpost in Africa. It's one of the things you have to be very careful about, because in Morocco, they still don't recognize necessarily Spanish possession. And it's just spectacularly beautiful, very teeny area. It's the first time I've ever been to a place where you step out of the hotel or coffee shop, and on the left, you can have the Mediterranean, almost a stone's throw, and a stone's throw on the right. I mean, it's that narrow at one point, you can have the Atlantic Ocean. Not that these bodies are necessarily, you know, no different. It's the same body of water, if you will. So it's that very northern part, you can see Gibraltar, you can see Spain, and it had been Portuguese controlled for many years, for many centuries. Spanish took possession of it, and Morocco still contests it. It was while Tupac Amaru was there, there was a siege by Moroccan forces, if you will, and it was also the battlefront for the Spanish when they invaded Morocco. So it was this incredible area back then, and today has this very odd feel. I spent a week there, so I don't claim to be an expert, but it's this odd field in some ways, a sort of Spanish paradise, a very nice lifestyle, and beautiful historic buildings, and not too much tourism. On the other hand, when you go into Morocco from there, which I did, the fence is massive. It looks like the U.S.-Mexico border, and there are Moroccans coming in to work every day in Ceuta, and people in all sorts of colonial, if you will. There's lots of barbed wire, so it has been in the news a great deal.
So there's Moroccan laborers, domestic servants, and so forth that come in.
They're coming every day, yeah.
And then
yeah.
Leave in the evening. I mean, like...
Yeah, in the evening, they shell back, and they're coming... Right. And you realize that part of, you know, again, it's a very colonial feeling. People will say, well, the good life is middle class might have, you know, maid come in every day and freshen up, or restaurants have, you know, much of the service is done by the restaurants. So
sounds like colonial Vietnam to from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Work on. Yeah.
But fortunately, and I must say this, there's a series of very dedicated historians in Spain and in Ceuta itself who are really like the project. And I just was very fortunate because I got their complete solidarity and a lot of help from these people.
Yeah. So how many decades was he imprisoned there?
He was there about 33 years.
So this years.
Is the bulk.
And this, you know, tiny little, In a dungeon down.
No, this is the fascinating thing. This is probably my biggest discovery that, if you will, the other biographies of him. We all would assume that he got very lucky. In the one moment of fortune, as I emphasize, this is a man of incredibly bad luck. As you know, just despondent, he's been mistreated, and God, he's held up in this little hellhole. No guards are nice to him except for the Swiss guard. When they send him across on the boat, he gets to Ceuta, and the person in charge of the boat sort of pointed him out and said, "This guy is not. This guy is different," because he was going across with murderers, kidnappers, others. They said he deserves better. So instead of being put in the jail, which are dungeon-like, I visited the remains of them, and they're horrifying, as you can imagine. He was allowed to be what's called a confinado, or confined. He could stay, he could move around. He had to report in. And so he worked, he was given basically to a silversmith who gave him room and board and abused him terribly. According to his memoirs, said they never let him sleep in the same place. The wife and the husband beat him if he didn't do well. He once spit. They saw him spitting in the house and they beat him up. So he eventually moves out on his own. He gets a small pension. He has to report in. He's confined to there. He's mistreated, but he's allowed mobility. And presumably, he raised product, and as a good campesino, he knew how to raise food. I mean, he knew how to work a garden, and he probably did odd jobs and such to survive. But he's there for over 30 years.
Yeah, in this small bit of territory. I mean, these are historically a very important 33 years. I mean, so... Yeah. What years would he be there? So at this point, is it 1785?
1787 to 1820.
Right. I mean, so this is the age of revolution, and he's
right.
As the title says, he's witnessing it from imprisonment in this Spanish possession in North Africa. I mean, it's just these layers of history and intersections are just so fascinating with this case study. And then there's this incredibly human story. So the book is fabulous, but it is horrifically depressing to get through those first couple of sections. I mean, you and Liz did an incredible recreation of the human suffering on the ships and the executions and so forth. But then there's this really touching moment that comes to dominate the last part of his life, where he makes friends with an Augustinian priest, Marcos Duran Martel. Mm-hmm. And who was this priest? Where does he come from? And how did he wind up? He's a fellow prisoner, right?
Right, right. He's equally fascinating character that I'm shocked there's not 18 biographies about. In fact, it's one thing I would love to sort of follow up on. He's a Peruvian mestizo, probably indigenous and Spanish roots, Augustinian priest who gets very involved. He leads a massive rebellion in Huánuco, one of the early rebellions in the Wars of Independence in Peru. And he, 1814.
Where would that be in today's map?
That would be from Lima going east, slightly north, going towards the Amazon jungle. So it's the Andes, a little bit greener. So it's one of the top.
But within the state of Peru.
Yeah, but not near Cusco, a little bit farther north.
Okay.
And so there's this mass rebellion that has been understudied. There's some good recent studies, but, been understudied, rising up a coalition of mestizos and local Creoles who say the Spanish, above all, is about tobacco. It's a tobacco area. They're imposing a monopoly. We're not getting enough money, the typical grievance, material grievance of the rebellions of this period. And indigenous people, locals, who said, we're being mistreated. And there's this really bloody conflict. They run the Spanish out. Dozens are killed. They control the area for 3 or 4 months. And then the Spanish send in the reinforcements from Lima. The big guns come in. The rebels divide. And they capture, they kill off the leadership. Duran Martel is saved, presumably, because he's a priest. Spanish are always not quite, this happens in Mexico. I mean, they're capable of killing priests, but I mean, it happened in the years in Mexico and elsewhere. But he is sent off to Spain and ultimately makes it to Ceuta in, I believe, 1815 or 18, I think I we have documents in 1815, he arrives there. And he and Juan Bautista develop a friendship that's just amazing. The deep love just exudes from the book. And Juan Bautista over and over again says, I would have never made it. But he's the one who got me out of all this. He kept my faith. And he was part of a circle of people who told stories about what's going on with the Napoleonic invasion of Iberia, what's going on with the British, who's winning the wars, they're getting, or what's happening in Venezuela, what's happening in Mexico. This is when all the rumors, and here's where maritime history really helps, because we have great material on this, are Ceuta is really just a perfect place, because they could actually see ships coming into the Mediterranean, you know, throughout that. So Durán Martel is just, he's with him until the very end. He's with him when he dies in 1827 in Buenos Aires.
In Argentina, Buenos Aires, yeah.
Yeah.
Does he help him with the appeals process?
He does. And this is one of the challenges is, we'll get to his memoirs in a minute, but Durán Martel is well-trained to be an Augustinian priest. You need a high-level education, knew Latin well, and certainly helped him write his memoirs. I don't think it's very common in those periods. He's not a ghostwriter. He doesn't appear. I don't think he's a ghostwriter. This was very common. More humble people would have more literate people help him. And he's the one, by then, he is beginning to, in 1814, to say, I deserve to be free. Liberals take power, or they're at least in power in Cádiz and areas, and Juan Bautista is saying, I have been a political prisoner for 27 years. I deserve freedom, and begins telling a story. And what I argue is this is the root of his memoirs, because we'll talk a bit about the doubts about his memoirs. But Durán Martel is there. Tell your story. They've got time. They've got paper. And they start sending these documents. And I was fortunate to find some. I'd hope to find more, but I was quite fortunate to tell his story. He was a martyr. He was not important to Bajamaro rebellion, but his whole tragic story.
And how is Juan Bautista released?
Well, when the liberals is a three-year liberal period, 1820, 1823, most of the Americas had been liberated, become, you know, Mexico is Mexico. Countries are being liberated, they start freeing the prisoners. In this terrible bureaucratic snafu, the official document that frees them all says all prisoners who have been, you know, in jail since, I don't know what year they put, or they set up a date that was after Tupac Amaru had gotten there. So the irony is he should have been the first one out, but it said, no, it doesn't include people who were jailed in the 1780s. We really just worried about, you know, after, I can't remember the date, 1795. So he's about to be released. They say, sorry, it doesn't say you. You've got to stay in jail. Durán Martel is included, and that's one of the passages where he stays. So they finally... This is where they use their contacts.
So Durán Martel could have been freed, but he could have been stayed with his friend.
And this is what Juan Bautista says. This is love. This is because this is friendship. He could have gone back. He could have gotten any boat across the Americas, but he waited for me. And so what they do is they met some very prominent liberals in Spain. They're now in power. They're writing them. They're using their contacts. They're starting their story out. And this is I was very fortunate. The liberal press covers the story. So I was able to track these narratives of, you know, these very strong romantic. And again, it does sound like the Count of Monte Cristo or something. Here's a guy who's been in jail for over 30 years. He has an unbelievable story. And this begins to circulate. So they finally are allowed out. And again, you couldn't make this up in a novel. They're leaving Ceuta, and Juan Bautista falls downstairs and breaks rib. He's hospitalized and delayed. And there's the book. I mean, there's a series of delays. They can't get the money together to pay for a decent ship, to pay for the boat to get to across the Atlantic.
And where do they go? And where does he finish his life?
Curiously, they end up in Buenos Aires. And this is one of the other lovely surprise in the book, Juan Bautista was known in Buenos Aires because Argentina, and it wasn't Argentina yet, it was still the United Province of Rio, it became Argentina, had an Inca moment in the 18-teens when Argentina was seeking independence, debating what it was about, there was discussion about naming an Inca king. This would, you know, satisfy some of the monarchists perhaps, and underlined Argentina's indigenous roots, which weren't nearly as strong as Peru or Bolivia. And Juan Bautista apparently had been a candidate in discussions years earlier, 1815, 1816.
While he's in prison.
He
on the other side of the world, they're talking about making him king.
And he gets to Buenos Aires, and you know, and I might have overdone this, but I think it was, he in his memoir said, people looked at me and I didn't know what it was. So we play this up that, you know, he's the Inca king, who is this guy? And he gets there to Buenos Aires, and that's why he's given a pension. And they basically subsidize him to write his memoirs.
So he's not a destitute ex-con trying to survive on the street. He found out that he was in the running to be for the throne, and then they give him a pension, and as you said, and they support him. And so the last years of his life are obviously more comfortable than previous.
They were. They're much better. He's free. Yeah. He's writing. He had befriended an Argentine hero of Wars of Independence, Asopardo, who apparently had him in his house. So he's relatively comfortable, but he still pens this very strong letter to Bolivar, Simón Bolívar, saying, you know, my last hope, and it's a very rhetorical letter. It's a very hard one to translate. It's in the primary document section. It was really florid. My last hope is to see the land of the Incas. I want to come back to Peru. Which he never does. Bolivar never answers him. We don't know if he never ever got the letter. Bolivar's fate changes over time, but he dies in 1827 in Buenos Aires. And it points out that he's, you know, never got to go back to his homeland.
And it's in this period where he writes his memoir, testimony, odyssey. I don't know what the correct terminology would be, but his experience. Tell us a bit about this document. You know, why did he write it, and how you make a point that this is almost entirely forgotten. It's discounted. It's silenced. Its legitimacy is questioned. Tell us about this document.
Well, it's such a shocking piece. He wrote it very quickly, and so critics would say in the trial he said he was illiterate, and then suddenly he appears this very anti-Spanish document months after, you know, less than a year after he arrives. And this is where I argue that A, he wasn't illiterate, and this is why in the book I put his signature, which is one of the ways, if someone has a florid signature, even today you can see their levels of literacy, and it's unclear. I think he probably had a basic education, and then years in jail or in Ceuta with this very erudite priest, they probably read Latin and things like that. And he also had the help, I believe, of Durán Martel and of this other character I mentioned, Asopardo. The other element, the story itself, I mean, how did he pull it back together so quickly? This is when I realized that he had done drafts of it in all of these legal documents. He had, you know, and in these interviews, or I'm not sure what the format was, in the newspaper saying, I was part of the Tupac Amaru Rebellion. My brother was a martyr for independence. Suddenly, now that these countries are becoming independent, he's a martyr, a hero. I'm the half-brother. And he tells his whole story. So he's pulling this together. Critics have said, well, he couldn't have written it. He was illiterate. It came out too quickly. It was too sort of perfect anti-Spanish. But I make the very, I hope, obvious point. If anybody had a reason to hate the Spanish, Juan Bautista had a pretty good story. This isn't, you know, proto-nationalist or nationalist BS. This is his very, very strong feelings. But as I describe in the book, one very important author, Pedro Angeles, who published these beautiful, in the 1830s, the first set of documents for the Tupac Amaru Rebellion, he looked at it and said, this is a fake. And I think it was in part because it's such a shocking document. It's so brilliant. It's so well told.
Too good to be true.
Exactly. It's like forgers. You know, if you do a forgery, you're supposed to make some mistakes. But they also, some people pointed out, but he's got a couple mistakes about the rebellion. But, you know, and I'm getting old enough where this makes sense to me now. You tell a story about something that happened over 40 years ago. He wasn't there when his brother was executed. For example, he gets his brother's execution wrong. You know, that's a good police detective would say when you someone was there, if they get a few things wrong, that's common. So it then entered, it was published in Buenos Aires, sort of forgotten every once in a while. There'd be an essay about it. There were a couple of very lovely articles about it in Argentine press in the 1930s, and it was sort of a debate about, is Argentine indigenous, are we immigrants, things like that. But all of this changes with another personality I bring in the book, Francisco Loaiza, this Peruvian diplomat and author who had been in Seville in the 1930s, just before the Civil War.
And
his daughter had taken a camera, because I learned what photocopying, you know, meant then, and took pictures of thousands of documents, including lots of documents of Juan Bautista. So the 1945, I believe, Francisco Loaiza publishes it, this little teeny edition of it, with brilliant footnotes that were unbelievably good research. He was right on nine. I mean, I found a couple things he got wrong in here, but really meant well. And this, if you will, began a bit of a resurgence of these memoirs since the 40s.
But he's still not a very well-known figure today in Peru?
No, it's surprising. I mean, in part because his brother overshadows him. He overshadowed him in life and death, and he's such a figure. He never returned to Peru. I think my prediction is Peru is having its bicentennial next year. 1821 is its official War of Independence, date of independence. Some people say it should have been earlier or started with Tupac Amaru, but I think there's going to be growing interest in him. But he certainly is not that well known, and there are a series of factors about it. I do think a lot of literary scholars have just doubted whether this was true. So I really hope my book at least says to people, this is legit. I can give you 5 or 6 really strong arguments why it's his story. It was published. I've done the paper trail of the different editions and things like that.
Yeah. Maybe a Spanish edition of this.
Yeah. It'll happen. Yeah. It's happening.
Yeah. Great. Great. That brings me to the Oxford Graphic History Series. Why did you bring this into comic form?
Yeah, your series you participated in, it was so lovely that it's so smartly done. I just said, this is a story for this. I mean, listeners have heard these incredible cities, transatlantic tale, and Lima and Cusco and Rio and Cadiz. And I just thought it would be it was so vibrant. I thought it'd be really worth telling in this form. So when I had the opportunity to work with Liz Clark and Oxford University Press, I was just delighted.
Yeah. So tell us about the process. How did you design the pages for Witness to the Age of Revolution? How did you and Liz Clark create the images? And by the way, I've worked with Liz Clark too, and listeners might be interested to hear that she's in South Africa. I've never met her. Did this entirely online. I assume you did the same. I don't think you went down to Cape Town. So how did you tell us about the process? How did you design the pages of the graphic section?
Right.
What did you want to convey with this visual form? And
and
what sort of source material did you and Liz use to create the images?
Yeah, no, these are the great questions. And I had some very good advice from a couple of people right away. This is the key to graphic history. When historians blow it, is you can't have too many words. You can't have, and so you've got to, I'm an historian. I've always disliked in writing and lecture, assume knowledge. I don't want to assume that my reader knows when the French Revolution was or what, the Spanish liberalism. So I wanted to give a lot of information, but you couldn't do it. So Liz was just masterful about that.
There's one brilliant page. I think is it bayonets or something? There's a shadow.
Yeah.
And it makes a timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's
cool.
Liz. Yeah.
Oh, just absolute genius.
So Liz really, so I had some good advice, but Liz really led me through. There's a process where you write the script where you say, what words what images go there? What words? Is it a quote or is it a declaration? And then where can I learn about this? And Liz, it's just an unbelievably fast learner. So, again, it's a great challenge because generations of historians, most of us haven't thought a lot about material culture, except maybe one specific thing. So people, if in the middle of a lecture, a student says, what were they eating at that meal? Or what did their shoes look like? We say, well, I don't know, or we make something up. So this is what you have to know. So for example, the first draft, the Andes were far too lush. The Andes in Cusco are quite dry and not quite barren. They're too high. They're above the tree line. And so this is a case where I said, here's a great web page of a Peruvian photographer in the 1970s, or, took some pictures of books that I had around it. And she just immediately got it. And then, I have emails to friends like, what did wine goblets look like in 1780? Right. 1780, we have a scene with a wine because somebody pointed out I had a completely anachronistic wine goblet. So there was a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
But she is just brilliant. And as you said, what she's really good at is wrapping into the images background information, timelines, maps, things like that. And that's where her, and that she takes all the credit for that.
She's fantastic. And, one of the things we mentioned previously is you also bring in some maritime history and illustrate life on the boats. And then I love the inclusion of the maps. It's something I did with Great Hanoi Rat Hunt, but you and Liz really excelled here. And this is a story that needs maps, right? I mean, the maps of the rebellion. And I think that you blend Incan cartography with sort of Western maps. That was really beautiful. And then showing the his odyssey around Cape Horn and to Brazil and on to Spain and Morocco and then back to South America. What did you try to do with the maps? Like, what were your goals?
Well, I mean, I always think there should be more maps. I mean, I read an article in the New Yorker about the Czech Republic, and I said, why didn't they put a little teeny map? You know, because I don't know where that river is or something like that. So I always think that's the kind of, when I read something in global history and I have no idea where it is, I lose interest after a while. You got to be locked in. Okay, this is that part of Albania. I've never been there, but so I really, and I just wanted to get to emphasize, you know, how hard these journeys were. I mean, going overland in chains from Cusco to Lima. I mean, I've done that many times on bus. It's a 24-hour bus ride, and that's brutal. So I wanted to bring up these different elements in the maps. And Liz was, you know, the challenge there. This is a talent that, you know, I have zero of, but is beauty, but not overloading the page, getting the information. She was really good about that. I would ask, like, is that too much information? You know, some of the readers and things would say, like, you don't need that date he was at that hamlet or something like that, because you know a good comic is relatively clear. You don't want lots and lots of writing. So, and she also, you know, broke up the, I had imagined it before I started, you know, reading the Oxford UP series and some of the others. I mean, there is still a tendency to go be very boxy, you know, or, you know, read, you know, like a comic strip, like, and that's no longer necessary. So she's got images flowing through the different ones.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, those pages are just fabulous. I mean, I think some of the images of the Spanish violent repression where the figures who are being, you know, tortured, that sort of sprawl across. And, you know, shocking, horrific, gripping, but also respectful and tastefully done. And I know that's really difficult to do, recreating images of such violence. One of the things I really loved is the way you guys included the documents into the graphic format. So the reader can actually see the sources as they're being created. And these are the sources that you looked at two centuries later. Can you tell us about that? Which documents did you include and why? And
yeah, I mean, part of it was from Ceuta. I had really just five or six documents about him, but they were, each one of them were like, you know, it's almost like classic history where, you know, a little fragment of something, anything. These ones, for example, a signature. That was when I said, this guy can write. You can't have that beautiful signature without being literate. And it was really exciting because we could track down where he lived. And of course, in Ceuta we went, and it's now some big ugly shoe store or something. It's in relative downtown, but you know, it's just that great author thing to be able to walk and, you know, go there. I can't remember what fantastic biographer said when she started a book, she always went to wherever the person lived, even though there was nothing left, just to get this feeling. So we tried to include them, and Liz did it instead of just having, you know, document section, which a lot of us would see. Well, she integrated them in there to get his signature, to get where he lived. To get these sort of things. There's a few for the rebellion itself as well.
Yeah. Did you run into any challenges with the graphic history? Anything you felt that you want to do, but you couldn't quite do it? Any limitations from the genre?
Yeah. You know, it was, we tried to, I mean, I really think it's important to have the comic, the art first. So we have that front and center. And then I have, you know, I have a brief preface. Then we have the art, which goes 80 or 90 pages. And then I have a pretty long introduction, 8, 15 or 20, with all the things we've been talking about, you know, did he really write these and things like that. So, but there were certainly, I mean, frustrations first was just, how am I ever going to know this stuff? Like, you know, what the shoes look like in Buenos Aires. And I had some really great, like the people I acknowledge were just fantastic, because someone, for example, an Argentine historian, Gabriel, a very prestigious Argentine historian, Gabriel Meglio, I ran by the Buenos Aires page, and he said, you've got crosses all over the cemetery. There was actually a secularization campaign in 1821 and they were all gone. I would have never found them. Yeah. I couldn't even find it in secondary literature. Huh. Things like that, just the frustrations. I wanted to find more about his life in Buenos Aires. The archives are great in Argentina. And to our kind of surprise, we haven't found much. Mm-hmm. And the other sort of question, the larger, I don't know, question I had throughout was, should some of these are much more first person. In other words, I don't have Juan Bautista saying things, except in a couple cases, they're almost all, we have quotes from the memoirs. And that's just a question of cultural appropriation. I felt really funny about doing that. I thought about, you know, what kind of Spanish do you speak, a very indigenous or a Quechua influenced. And that is often a form of, you know, very racist satire. So I didn't want to go there. So I felt like I wanted to respect his memoirs, you know, in a few places I have him say go, but I don't, it's not him telling his account. And I think because of the richness of the story, we pulled that off.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did. It's really successful. I mean, it's just really utilizes the graphic genre, just in a fabulous way. So taking up a lot of your time, and we really appreciate that, but I've got just two more questions for you before I let you go. First, can you suggest two related books that you would urge listeners to read?
Sure. I mean, I could, there's a lot, there's a long sort of bibliographical essay there, but I for the Tupac Amaru period, I really like Sergio Cyrulnikov's book. He's an Argentine historian. The translation is published by Duke University Press, called Revolution in the Andes, The Age of Tupac Amaru. This came out a year or two before my book, and I believe it's 2012 or so, and that worried me first, but it's actually a synthesis. But don't take that as, oh, it's a textbook. No, it's a really brilliant distillation of what happened in Peru, which is more my focus, what happened in what became Bolivia, the Catarista, another rebellion. It's a really readable, very, very smart account. If you're intrigued about that, I always say to start there. A book that really inspired me just as I was doing the copy edits, it came too late, but it's part of this. I mean, we sort of talked about this, what field did I not expect to read a lot in? And I ended up reading a lot in, and I loved it, maritime history. There's all this great stuff coming. I really like Vincent Brown's Tacky's Revolt, The Story of an Atlantic Slave War. This is about a 18th century rebellion in Jamaica. But it just brilliantly crosses the Atlantic. It doesn't just sort of have the African part as a prologue, but it integrates it, it moves back and forth, it does microhistory, and it pays an incredible fine attention to geography and cartography and space. So that's the book that, right as always, the final touches, editing, really inspired me.
Yeah, and that was Vincent Brown, Tacky's
Revolt. Vincent Brown, Tacky's Revolt. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Published back over.
Okay. Yeah. And finally, what are you working on now, and what can we hope to see from you next?
Well, I've got some different projects. I have with a colleague here at UC Davis, Michael Lasara. We've translated and edited the memoirs of Jose Carlos Aguero in Peru, which is a sensational book. He is the child, his mother and dad were Shining Path guerrilla members, executed extrajudicially by the Peruvian state. And he wrote these, it's an incredible book. It's part memoir. It's part just philosophical reflections on memory, anguish, guilt. And this is an absolutely brilliant book that was a little bit understated or underdone. So what Michael was a lead translator. We translated it, and then we did a long interview with him, a 25-page interview with him about the book, what it's like. We met with him for several days. He's now a 40-year-old public intellectual in Peru, really important about this. Shining Path is a shockingly controversial and very tricky topic. And that's coming out through University Press in, I believe, January.
Okay.
And the other sort of large project is, I'm writing a book on a monograph on violence in the Shining Path, contemporary Peru, 1980s to 2000, what that war was all about. There's been a lot written about it, but I'm using the focus of violence and how did people get involved, what happened. This has proven to be a very, very, very challenging book, a very harrowing book, but that I'm working on and drafting maybe in a year or two.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing that. So Chuck, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thanks so much to the listeners for staying with us.
Okay. So this has been a conversation with Professor Charles F. Walker of the University of California, Davis, and author of Witness to the Age of Revolution, The Odyssey of Juan Bautista Tupac Amaro, published by Oxford University Press in 2020, a recent addition to the Oxford University Press's Graphic History Series. I'm Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.